Pets are such a wonderful part of life. And if you own, if you have a pet, and you're like me, you probably do most anything to make sure that pet stays happy and healthy. That's what we're going to be talking about for the next 90 minutes or so with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She takes time each month to spend some spend time with us and give us some advice on keeping our pets healthy and happy. Sandy, great to have you back.
It's nice to be here, you know, and I'm not spending time. I'm enjoying this time, you know. It's always a lot of fun to come here and hear all the questions that people have, and I'm always surprised at what comes up.
Yeah, World Rabies Day.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody will bring that up, but it's September 28th.
Yeah, and what this is I, you know, the reason why I brought this up is almost a year ago, I went to the Philippines, and when I was in Manila, they were giving me a tour, and I saw this, you know, English is what they speak there, and there's a sign up, it says rabies clinic. And I was like, oh, look at this, they've got a rabies clinic for people to take their dogs to get rabies vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, that's for people. That there are so many stray animals, and rabies is such a huge problem that they actually have a clinic there that if you do get bit by a stray or wildlife, you can go directly in and get started on the rabies prophylaxis. But they estimate that about in the United States, about 40,000 people a year have to go through rabies shots because of exposure to wildlife or to, you know, pets where we don't have rabies information. And we have about 6,000 rabid animals a year diagnosed in the country. So it's not as common in other countries as it is in other countries, but we still have it here, and it is deadly. And so, you know, it's, you know, each year about 55,000 people die worldwide because of this. And it's a preventable disease by getting your pet vaccinated. And my goal as a veterinarian is to have every pet up to date on their vaccinations. And, you know, there are ways of getting this done. There are, various, you know, low cost clinics. If finances are an issue that people can go to, and, you know, it is the law. So get it done if you haven't got your pet updated.
Another area that I know we wanted to talk about a little bit was obesity. Fat, you know, they're fat people, but we've got fat pets too.
Yeah. And you know what? On October 10th, and this is going to be before I'm back to do the next show, they're actually going to be doing a Pet Obesity Awareness Day survey, and pet owners can sign up and actually learn a little bit more about obesity in their pets. There's an estimated that about 43% of adult dogs, or 53% of adult dogs and 55% of cats in the last annual survey that was done. So over half the pets in the United States are overweight. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are the ones that are dishing up their food, you know? So we need to, you know, make sure that we keep our pets healthy, because we see arthritis and decreased longevity and diabetes and all the same health problems that can affect people affect our pets. And we want to make sure that they live a long life and not have to deal with having these extra pounds on them. And if anyone wants to, you know, sign up and get the information sent to them for this survey that then they would mail in, they just have to go to a website called Pet Obesity Prevention, all one word, .com. And there's lots of great information on there about calories of treats and kind of average weights, what pets should weigh, and even all the calories of the main, you know, the foods that are out there, pages and pages. It's a place that I go to all the time, because people will come in and say, I'm feeding my dog brand X and I can't find the calories, and that way I can figure out what's on, you know, what they should be being fed. So, but someone wants to sign up for that, feel free to do that. I'm going to for our clinic. So every patient I see is going to get registered into this anonymous survey.
That is very, very cool. Well, we can do that with our pets too, our cats.
You definitely can.
Sue and Mequon, thank you for waiting. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm watching my son's dog. We own a dog, but I'm watching my son's dog. And when he came up to our house, he was on a 5-day regimen of prednisone. He has disgusting eye goobers in one eye.
Mm-hmm.
He finished the treatment, and they're back. I did take him in then to our vet. He lives in another city.
Okay.
And our vet looked at it and didn't see any real problem. She was not concerned with it. They do continue, and they are kind of disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are they normal? Are they contagious?
Very good questions, and it all depends. When we see discharge from an eye, the things that I would do when a patient's presented to me would be to, first of all, check for infections anywhere else on the body, too, and make sure that the rest of the pet is healthy. And then I would probably do what's called a Schirmer tear test. It's a little piece of calibrated filter paper that sucks up tears to see if the dog is producing enough tears, because that is one of the reasons why we'll see discharge from the eye. The eye continues to make mucus but doesn't make enough of the liquid part of the tears, and so you just get this kind of goo built up. My own dog, Vanna, has a dry eye, and she's on daily medication to try to keep her eye more comfortable for her. It's known as keratoconjunctivitis seca, KCS, and people get it too, so that'd be one thing I would do. The other thing I would look at is, is there anything like wrong with the cornea, like a corneal ulcer? And I'd probably stain the eye with a little fluorescein stain. It's a fluorescent stain that will pick up defects in the cornea. And then I would probably numb the eye and have a look under the third eyelid, make the dog feel a little more comfortable so I can get in there and actually have a look and see how reactive the tissue is under that third eyelid and look for foreign bodies or anything else that could be causing problems. Our ophthalmology department has also been seeing dogs that have what's called a qualitative tear defect, and I'm really not up on it at all, but they use a different type of stain, and I've been seeing a lot of cases that have these chronic goopy eyes that need to be on daily medication, because even though their eyes look wet, they're not the right type of tears that they're making, and so they are more prone to infections. I'm not sure why the dog was put on prednisone. Usually if you're seeing a green or a yellow discharge, you're looking at needing topical antibiotics, in an eye ointment or drop to be able to get the problem under control. So again, I'm not sure what the veterinarians did, how in depth they got into looking at these eyes, but that would be the way I would approach it.
Okay, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Sue. Crystal from Milwaukee sent us something on Facebook, and she said, "Help! My indoor cats have fleas. The downstairs neighbor dog cat has them, and we share a hallway.
Yeah.
How can I protect and treat my cats, the house, and my sanity?"
Yeah, I think a couple of things. It would be very helpful if everybody went on the same, treatment regimen so that we could get the fleas under control, which means talking to your neighbors and seeing if you can, help them out with maybe, getting their dog and cat on a topical flea medication. There are lots of them available that are very effective. The monthly topicals that go on Frontline or any of the fipronil-based products. The Advantage or Advantix in the case of dogs. So there's a number of things like that you can use that work very well and provide the pet with a month of therapy. I have not had to fumigate a home or have the owners do it. I don't go in and do it, but in eons, because we have these great flea products now that really, really work. Other things that you could do would be vacuuming. Vacuuming is going to suck up flea eggs and flea larvae and some of the flea droppings that the immature fleas are feeding on, and that's going to help get things under control. And when I say vacuum, I mean tile floors, hardwood floors, baseboards, under the couch, lift the cushions off the couch, down in all those cracks and crevices, because that's where you're going to find the immature fleas. And then I'd be on the lookout for potential harbors of fleas that are outdoors that are allowing the other pets to bringing fleas in. And that would be raccoons and possums are probably the big things. And so if you've got any wildlife living in an outdoor shed or your garage or under a deck, getting rid of those from your environment is probably going to make control of your pets a lot easier as well.
There we go. Buzz wrote on Facebook, "We are getting a new puppy, a golden retriever, Thursday. Hopefully we've thought of most things, but maybe there are some ideas that you might have about health-wise for bringing one home."
Yeah, it's always exciting to bring a pet home, and having everything you need from food dishes and the food. I would be recommending that you stay with the food that the breeders had the puppy on, so you're not doing an abrupt diet change initially when you bring the pet home. A quiet place for the pet to be able to rest. So in this case, it's going to be a large dog. So getting a kennel, there's some that are available now that have an insert in it so it can kind of grow with the pet as they get older. older, some appropriate toys so that you can redirect the dog to a toy when it starts to chew on things in the home, and make sure you puppy-proof your home. So I had someone in the other day and said, my dog puppy keeps chewing on my shoes and socks. I'm like, well, if they're not on your feet, they shouldn't be out sitting there for your puppy to get at. So whose problem is it? And, you know, and get that stuff put away. So puppy-proofing, everything's off of low tables. You know, put away anything you don't want to see chewed on. I've had puppies chew reading glasses and remote controls and cell phones and all kinds of stuff. So we just tend to leave those things down right where they can get at them. So clean up your house. When I would say, you know, get toys, make sure that they are appropriate, which means some of the things that I would say don't use would be tennis balls, that rough coating on the outside, that because it's like a felt-like coating is abrasive and it'll wear those teeth down. So keep, you know, rubber balls and things are okay, but no tennis balls. And our dental service says that if any toy is hard enough that you hit yourself in the shin with it and it hurts, don't put it in the puppy's mouth. So that would mean natural bones, Nyla bones, not the puppy Nyla bones, but the hard Nyla bones can break teeth. So, you know, try to stay away from those and get an assortment of things that would be the appropriate size for your puppy as well. And make sure that the toys grow as your puppy grows too, so they don't swallow them. Yeah.
Melissa in Beaver Dam has a question for you. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have two male cats, and they're both spayed, neutered, and the one, we have issues with him urinating on things. Usually it's, you know, down by the laundry, we put out a pile of clothes and it gets urinated on almost within the same day. But most recently, we had some couches, that we brought into the basement that, you know, we wanted to have for a family room, and we introduced them upstairs initially for a couple months just to hopefully get them used to it, and then we just moved them downstairs, and within, I'd say, a week or two, he urinated on it. And so I'm just kind of wondering if there's some other things that we're not doing. Excuse me. We have two litter boxes, and they're quite a ways away from where they eat. And so I'm just really wondering what I need to do to make him not do this.
This is such a frustrating problem. On Friday, I had a first-year vet student come in to see me with his cat, and it's 4:00, and I'm ready to get out of the clinic and, you know, start my weekend. And as he's walking out the door, he's got a new kitten. He says, "Oh, by the way, Dr. Sawchuk, my mother has a cat that isn't using the litter box. What do I do?" And I'm like, "Oh, okay, you got a couple of hours, you know." So these are time-consuming, not only for you with the cleanup and everything and frustrating, but also for the veterinarian. They can be a time-consuming appointment to try to get to the bottom of what's going on. And I did a lecture on this yesterday and spent an hour just kind of going over, things that students need to, when they're in an exam room, ask an owner regarding their cats and their litter box habits. So the first thing we always do is make sure that you have provided your cats with the best litter box experience possible. You want to make what a colleague of mine called the golden toilet for your cats. And you have two cats, you said, and you should be having at least three litter boxes. And so having a litter box in the basement, I think, would be appropriate. And maybe in your laundry room, I would make sure clothes are not left on the floor, because if they've developed a surface preference, you know, they like the feel of clothing under their feet for going to the bathroom. You're going to need to make sure that's put up and kept, you know, out of sight and out of mind. So, you know, getting rid of the preferred surfaces would be helpful. But at least three litter boxes, three separate locations in your home. The litter boxes should be big enough that the cat could move around comfortably, and that means 1.5 times the length from head to butt. So if you've got some big boy cats, the standard litter boxes you can buy in pet stores are not big enough. And so I tell people to go out and buy storage bins, cement mixing trays, which are inexpensive. You can get them at home improvement stores. Those seem to work really well, and they're inexpensive. Make sure that you're not using liners. Sometimes it may or may not be cause of one of the problems, that you are not using a covered litter box that harbors odors and can often make a cat feel trapped, especially if there's any conflict between the two cats. I kind of look at covered boxes like porta potties at the state fair. You know, you're crowded and you can't move around in them very well and a little smelly. And then making sure that you're using a preferred litter. The soft, scoopable, sandy litter seems to be what's liked best. And it's preferably unscented, but if you do need to use something with an odor eliminator, try to use one of the charcoal or carbon-based litters versus one that has baking soda in it. There seems to be a preference difference for cats with that. And I've had some problems with cats with the wheat-based litter and the pine litter. So even though they may be scoopable, some cats don't like those. So staying with a clay litter and clean the litter box a couple of times a day. I actually get down in there and scoop. Then you need to once you've done all that, get your cat in to make sure that there isn't any medical problems. So have a urine sample checked, having them, evaluated by your veterinarian, and once you've got that taken care of, then we start looking at other behavioral reasons. Is your cat just not liking the litter box, or are they urine marking? And those are approached very differently. And get some good odor eliminator. I'm not sure what you're using. My two favorite products are either Urine Off. You can just Google that, and you'll find all the stores in your area that carry it. And there's another product called AIP, Anti-Icky Poo, that actually comes with a syringe and a big needle, so you can get it into the upholstery on your couch or into carpet padding to get where the odors actually are being harbored that the cat can smell and go back to. So that is my 5-minute spiel. Give me 2 hours and I may be able to help your cat. So,
and you did that in about 5 minutes.
There we go.
Almost exactly.
Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening in. You can join in. The lines are filled now, but here's the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Sandy, you told me that you were going to be able to tell us how to figure out if a pet is left pawed or right pawed.
Yeah, this is kind of just a fun thing to do. You know, it does make a difference for certain animals like racehorses, which, or racing dogs, which go around the track, should probably be, I don't know which they have to lead with their left, because they're like NASCAR drivers, left, left, okay. But, it's just kind of a fun thing. It's probably not going to make any difference for your pet. But little simple things that you can do. I mean, when in humans, they know that about 90% of us are right-handed and 10% are left-handed. And in studies that they've looked at in pets, it's pretty much split half and half. And so you've got some, though, that are ambidextrous. And so, it's a fun thing to do. So a couple things you can do. One would be put something gooey on the pet's nose, like a little peanut butter, and see which paw they use to try to get it off. Watch your dog when they're scratching at the door to come in and see which foot is used. And you'll probably find one is used more than the other. You can also look at cats. If you have a toy that's dangling, which foot do they use to bat at it initially? They may switch to using both, but you'll see, usually a preference for one if they are right or left pawed. You can hide a piece of food underneath a container and see which foot they try to tip the container over to get the food out. They're just fun little things to do, and you can, then have at your next cocktail party, you can say, I have an ambidextrous cat, so.
Or mine's left-handed.
Yes.
Left-pawed.
Right.
There you go. Well, that sounds like fun. I'm going to try that out on Coco and Tiger.
There you
and
go.
We'll see what happens.
Okay.
Teresa in Ironwood, Michigan. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thanks. My daughter has two cats, and one of them developed pillow paw, and the vet treated it with some kind of medication, but he got sick from that.
I have no idea what you mean by pillow paw.
Oh, it's a lump on the bottom of his paw, and it doesn't go away. Doesn't seem to hurt him.
There's lots of reasons why cats can have their pads or their foot become swollen, but I've never heard of it actually given a name, pillow pop. That's a new one on me, and it may just be something that the veterinarian that the cat was taken to has just decided to start using. We do see some autoimmune problems where cats can develop problems with their pads ulcerating and swelling. Sometimes we'll see, especially in indoor-outdoor cats, if they get into fights, you can get localized infections. There's some cats can get what are called cutaneous horns, which are little, it's keratinized material that kind of builds up on the pad, and it can make it look a little deformed and funny, but that's, usually not a big problem for the cat, although some cats that develop that have issues with being feline leukemia positive, so we always want to screen for that. So I think what I'm going to have to do is you're going to have to try to get actually the diagnosis from the veterinarian to find out what it was.
Oh, he said it was probably immune.
Okay.
And it's developing on the other paw now.
Yeah, but if it is an autoimmune problem, then what we'd be looking at is usually using drugs that are going to suppress the immune system, such as usually, long-term steroids. And there are some steroids that are better tolerated in cats than others. There's one that we use long-term called budesonide, and some cats do better with that than they do with prednisone. Mm-hmm. So if it has been diagnosed as an autoimmune problem, that's the path you usually have to go down, and you're looking at typically lifetime therapy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, good
luck.
Thank
you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. Becky in New Berlin, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a Beagle Terrier mix, and every year, I've had him for 5 years now, every year at the fall, he gets a bad itch, probably an allergy. I had him into the vet a couple of years, and he told me he had a bad allergy. He gave me some medicine, and he told me that I could just as well give him Benadryl. He doesn't have anything really bad, except he's so uncomfortable all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'll last till the first frost.
Yeah. Well, he probably does have seasonal allergies. We get hay fever and dogs itch.
Right.
And
I'm
going to just kind of go through some of the things that I would be recommending to keep your dog comfortable. Yeah, ideally we would, selective breeding. So you've got a mixed breed dog, that's kind of a crapshoot as to what you're going to get genetically. But, if you're going with a purebred dog, you'd want to make sure that if it's a golden retriever that you don't have allergies in their line. So that's one thing to do. You want to start early. The earlier in the season you start with your treatment before the dog becomes really super itchy, the better. And it's going to be easier to keep under control rather than trying to put a big fire out once it's already started. So many dogs that are itchy also get secondary bacterial and yeast infections, and that adds to the itch. They're constantly licking their feet, scratching their ears, and then they break their skin open and the skin gets inflamed. And so treating those, and that would mean that your veterinarian would be probably doing some cytology, taking some of the surface cells off of the skin and having a look under the microscope to see if there is the evidence of an infection, and then getting those treated. Other simple things that you can do is, wash your pet's bedding every day. That is, you're going to find that the dog goes outside and then brings in pollens and molds and things, and it's going to just build up. So washing the bedding every once a week, and using maybe a HEPA filter vacuum or even an air cleaner in your house, and keeping the windows shut so that at least your dog has an area that they can be in where they're not going to be exposed to the allergens. Very similar to what we would be, doing if we had allergies. Keeping your pet bathed, and many people just don't want to do this, but probably twice a week, bathing them is going to wash off some of the allergens that may be on the surface as well. So that'll be really helpful. And then because this is flea season in the fall as well, we don't want to add flea allergy on top of environmental allergies. So using one of those, a topical flea control agent is really important. And then, we're looking at other therapies such as fatty acid supplements, steroid sprays topically, and, you know, other drugs that we sometimes have to jump to using. There's one called cyclosporine that we use very commonly in dogs. And it's, you know, fairly safe. It's expensive, but it may make your dog feel a lot more comfortable during this time of the year. So, yeah, it's a tough one. Antihistamines may help, but they usually just make the dog a little groggy. So,
yeah.
And you can try different ones. I mean, one may not work, and there's several different antihistamines you can try.
Lots to think about there, Becky. Thanks a lot for...
Internet. Can I ask one more question? The internet suggests oatmeal bath. Do you think that's good for him?
Again, the colloidal oatmeal may just help with making the skin feel a little more comfortable. Sometimes just even cool water soaks. It just takes down the fire a little bit, too, and makes them feel better. So definitely you can use that. But pretty much any cleaning shampoo is going to get rid of the allergens on the hair coat. So, but if there is a secondary infection going on, you may need to, jump to using a medicated shampoo that your veterinarian would provide for you.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Becky. Maggie in Blue River. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have an older mini dachshund, and he has pancreatitis that flared up. It flared up a year ago, and it flared up again this year. And I was wondering if you could give some tips on home management of a situation like this, and also how long do you think I could be giving him Serenia?
Well, Serenia is an anti-nausea drug, and it helps stop dogs from vomiting. And typically, it's only used for a few days. We don't use it long term. It seems to be very safe using it for several days in a row. But we typically use it for when dogs are traveling and they may be on the road for 2 or 3 days, and that's kind of how we typically use it. But pancreatitis is one of those things. The pancreas makes all the digestive enzymes, and typically we'll see flare-ups when the dog has had got into some trash or a fatty meal. And when we've got patients that have chronic pancreatitis where they keep getting it over and over again, we make lifestyle changes when it comes to diet and like to have them on a low-fat diet that's easily digested. So we'll usually put them on a diet like Hill's makes one called RD or WD. Nestle Purina makes one that's a low-fat diet as well. So there's a number of different things out there that you could use. But typically the commercial foods that you're going to be able to buy at pet stores or grocery stores are going to be too high in fat for your dog. So this would be something you could purchase from your veterinarian. And it's just, you've got to be on that lookout for, keeping everything put up so that the dog isn't getting into that, cheese dip that got left on the coffee table.
All right. There you go. Maggie, thank you very much for calling. An email from Lisa in Verona. I've recently gotten news about one of my cats is diabetic, currently getting 3 units of insulin 2 times a day. We've just begun this journey, need to get him stabilized. He's gone in for 1 daily blood glucose monitoring. They had me purchase Science Diet, dry food and canned food also. My question is, are there alternative foods that are higher in protein that would be more helpful with his diabetes than this food?
Yeah, I think that the food that was listed there is one called WD that Hill's makes, and it's a weight control diet. It's a higher fiber diet and a low fat diet.
Lots of corn and other grains.
Yeah, the goal with treating diabetic cats is to preferably have them on a high protein diet. And there's a couple of commercially available ones that you can get from your veterinarian. There's one that is called DM that Nestle Purina makes. It's diabetes diet. And then one called MD that is made by the Hill's company. But I'm going to recommend a website for this emailer to go to, and it's called Binky's Page. I know that sounds like a weird name,
yeah,
but Binky was a cat that was diabetic, and this person has an excellent, excellent webpage that gives you all kinds of information on managing the diabetic cat, including commercial diets that are out there that are appropriate. There are many such as, there's some Fancy Feast brands that work really well for these cats, and it'll break down all the food into, the fat and the protein levels and fiber levels and so on and carbohydrate levels. and give you the ones that are, you know, are preferred for cats that are diabetic. So that's where I would look. In fact, I go to that website at least weekly to check on different diets for my cats.
So it's Vinky's page, tripod.com.
Yes.
And we'll put it up on our Facebook page.
Okay.
Put a link on the Larry Mueller Show. That sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. We got a Facebook question from Becca. I've read that some of the flea meds that can be purchased online through web pages such as 1-800-PET-MEDS are often counterfeit. How can I tell if the preventive meds I purchase are real? Should I buy only from my vet?
Good question. And, you know, they're definitely you're going to be much safer dealing with your veterinarian because they know the weight of your pet. They're going to be able to know what makes up your household so that you're not buying a product to put on your dog that could potentially be toxic for the cat and they like to cuddle together. So that is always the best place to at least start. But if you're looking at wanting to order online, there's a symbol that you'll see on the startup page of the pharmacies, and it's called VetVips, and it stands for Veterinary Verified Internet Pharmacy Practice or something like that. But it's a little gold seal that you'll see on them, and PetMeds happens to be one that has that seal on it. But I just had a client that ordered some flea and tick preparation from, I don't know what it was. It was some, like, you know, Joe's, you know, animal meds or something. Yeah. And when she got it, she got a large tube of Frontline without the packaging and a syringe so that she could drop the right dose to put on her pet. Oh. And I'm like, I don't even know if that's the, you know, the right product. You want to make sure it's in the sealed box, that it hasn't been opened. And that's something that you've got to know the pharmacy that you're dealing with online. And if someone is determined to, you know, order online, and I can tell you that most veterinarians are going to be competitive with online pharmacies, and some of the products, like, you know, Frontline Plus, if you purchase it through an online pharmacy, you don't get their guarantee, which is if you're using this and your pet gets fleas and you've purchased it from your veterinarian, they will call in a fumigating, like a parasite, mm-hmm. What do you call it? You know, like parasite company that comes into your house. Yeah, I can't remember.
Fumigators.
Fumigator, okay. They will hire somebody to come in and treat your home for you. And it's like a $400 plus expense. And so you'll get that guarantee if you purchase it from your veterinarian and not online. So that's another mm-hmm. reason to work with your veterinarian.
Absolutely. Jeanette in La Crosse, we turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a 15-year-old little female Yorkie, and over Labor Day weekend, we noticed that she stopped eating and drinking for 2 days, and which was really odd. So we took her in. Long story short, he found out that she had an enlarged liver, spleen, and heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took an x-ray, of course, and then he did blood work, and the blood work came back wonderful. He said he can't believe that this dog has got this problem. So he concluded that it must be congestive heart failure. And so I just was wondering, what is the long-term prognosis? He gave her some pills.
Okay.
And that's been wonderful. She's like bounced back and she's peppy again.
Good,
and he said
good.
If she did, that it would probably be pretty conclusive that it is congestive heart failure.
Do you know what the medication was that your dog got put on?
Gosh, I'm sorry.
Was it Lasix or furosemide or pimobendan? Anyway, that's all right. Heart failure, again, very common cause of death in older small breed dogs. They typically get valvular degeneration, and as those valves stretch, the heart doesn't pump as well, and you'll end up having fluid building up in the lungs. And sometimes if you've got right and left-sided heart failure, you may see some organ enlargement in the abdomen. You may have fluid in the abdomen as well. So it can present a number of different ways. Many times these dogs are coughing as well because they have fluid building up in the lungs. It is a fatal disease, but it can be managed medically sometimes for a long period of time. And you're usually looking at using combinations of different things, something that's going to make the heart pump better. There's a drug called Pimobendan, which is wonderful, and dogs really respond well to that. We will often have to have these dogs on diuretics, such as Lasix, and so they may be on that. And then, of course, if they're on diuretics, you have to be really careful with monitoring their electrolytes, and so you'll become good friends with your veterinarian to go in for periodic lab work. You know, it's a matter of you know, making sure that your dog is comfortable and always be watching for subtle changes like appetite changes. And sometimes the medication has to be tweaked. But eventually, they're not going to respond well to treatment. And heart failure is not a fun way to go. And unfortunately, you're probably going to have to make that tough decision at some point down the road. Not today, maybe not next month or next year, but it's going to happen. And expecting your dog to be able to die naturally with heart disease is really, I mean, they drowned. They panic, and it's not a fun way to see a pet go. So that's something to be prepared for down the road.
So you think she could have maybe a couple years yet? Or
it really depends on what I'd be recommending for getting a better prognosis would be to have an echocardiogram done, where they can look at the function of the heart muscle and how those valves are working, and that way you'd have some idea of how strong the heart actually is. So, and if your vet can't get that done, then you might be looking at going to a specialist, and we have a full cardiology department at the veterinary school here in Madison, and they'd be more than willing to have a look at your little Yorkie for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much. For calling. I appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you so much for joining in and listening in. Questions? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question, you can go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question. If you got a pet photo, we always love to see those. Post one of those on my Facebook page as well. It's at the Larry Mueller Show. Steve in Sun Prairie's been waiting for a while, so let's go to Steve. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a friend, Chris, who just took delivery of a new rescue dog, and she's rather curious as to what breeds might be intermingled in that rescue dog.
Yeah, yeah. I know who this is, and I saw the dog, and it is the cutest little thing. It came into the clinic, and she calls the dog Mystery Meat, and I was like, I've never heard anybody call their pet Mystery Meat, but definitely it looks like it. Who knows what's in it? You can do now genetic testing for pets, and it's probably not going to provide you with anything more than some information as to maybe what breeds may be in the pet, how reliable it is, some people really question, when they get the results back, they're like, there's no way that this little dog has Mastiff in it, but who knows? I asked the company one time when I was at a meeting if I submitted either a blood test or a cheek swab from my registered English bulldogs that we've got multiple generations where we know that they are bulldogs, what's going to come back? And remember, even a purebred dog is made up of a bunch of other breeds, and you're probably going to end up seeing, things like Mastiff and other, other breeds thrown in, even in a purebred dog. So you sometimes get some interesting information back, and I think it may be worth, I think the tests run $40-$45, I can't remember, but there's one called the Wisdom Panel is the one that I'm most familiar with, and it's by the Mars Company. They actually were the ones that mapped out the dog genome. So other companies have now, are doing some things with that as well. So I think it's fun. Is it going to make any difference for the dog? No.
No.
But yeah.
Okay.
Well, do you think it's actually worth the money? I mean, are you going to get accuracy at all?
Well, the company,
like the handwriting at the state fair.
Yeah, that's about what it is. Some people will, the companies that make these testing kits will say, well, it'll help your veterinarian with planning down the road as to what health problems the dog may have, so that, maybe if it comes back as, Yorkie, you'd know that, well, you know, they may be more prone to heart disease, or if it's, you know, certain diseases show up in certain breeds, so you are able to be watching for them. You know, and again, genetics is one of those things where just because your dog has a certain breed mixed in it, does that mean you inherited the baggage that goes along with that breed? Maybe, maybe not. And so sometimes it ends up maybe creating a little more worry than anything. So
than you need.
Yeah. So I think it's mainly just a fun thing to do, kind of like finding out if your pet's right or left-handed. It's not going to make any difference. It's just going to be, you know, that information is going to be there, and it's no longer mystery meat. It's going to be, you know, you'll know the ingredients. Yeah.
There you go. Thank you, Steve.
Wisdom panel. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot. Oh, Martin in Eagle River. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a 5.5-year-old, 75-pound, hardworking golden retriever that I use for bird hunting starting Saturday and right into January. And in some of my gun dog magazines, veterinarians have written articles about using some kind of supplement for joint health. I've never done that on any of my bird dogs. I just was wondering if those things are really effective or not, or if I should be using one, and if so, what I might be using.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them on the market, and it basically comes down to they're usually a glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate. They may have another ingredient called MSN. There may be some green lip muscle in it. There's could be some fatty acids to help modify the inflammatory response in the body. So there's a number of different ones that are available. Is it going to help your dog? Maybe. Is it going to hurt? No. And so I think if cost isn't an issue, I'd say, you know, by all means, go with it. I was at a talk a few years ago, and somebody was talking about these joint supplements, and it was a human medicine, and they were saying that, you know, this person's belief is that everybody should be put on it the day you start being affected by gravity, which means the day you're born, and because your joints are already starting to age even as you're growing. I think that might be a little extreme, but, you know, I think that it's, you know, if your dog's healthy and happy right now, it may just help with cartilage repair, making the synovial fluid healthier and a little more lubricating. Talk to your vet as to what brand they happen to like. The ones that we use at the veterinary school are typically either Dasaquin, made by the Nutramax company. It is one of the companies that we know you get what's on the label. That's the problem with nutraceuticals, is there isn't a lot of checks and balances. And the same person that was talking about having, you know, people on it from, you know, the day you start walking, said that there's more glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate sold in the United States than actually manufactured. So that tells you that you may not be getting what's on the label. So work with your veterinarian and find out what brand they happen to like. I just, you know, gave the one that the vet school typically uses, but there are lots and lots of other ones out there. Glycoflex is another one that I've had some good success with as well. And it comes in Glycoflex 1, 2, and 3. 3 is the better of them, and it's going to give you kind of more bang for your buck. So
He does get a performance food mostly year-round. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of other kinds of, I don't even know. I mean, I read the label. I don't understand what it is. It's some kind of things in there. So
yeah, some of the performance foods are going to be higher in calories. They may have, because it's going to be for working dogs, some of these joint protective agents in it. Almost all pet food is going to have some glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate in it just because of the ingredients that get put in it. But it's typically not at therapeutic levels. Even the diets that are joint diets, like that are prescribed for dogs with joint disease, that can be very effective, you still have to use an outside source of a joint supplement. It's not going to be enough in the diet. So I'd still consider using it. It won't hurt.
Well, so. It isn't going to hurt.
Yep.
Lisa in Evansville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Sawchuk.
Hi.
Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Our little Australian Shepherd, Sky, got stepped on by one of the horses earlier
Whoa.
This summer.
Ouch. Yep.
She broke all 4 metatarsals in
Ooh.
Her right front. Oh, snap.
Okay.
She, 10 weeks later and 4 pins later, and our vet did a wonderful job of patching her up, but she's got the bandages off last week, and she's barefooted now.
Okay.
And she's not really stepping on it quite very much. She's not one of your bolder Australian shepherds. So when she's not thinking about it, she uses it.
Okay.
She goes after a cat.
Okay.
She dances for dinner. She uses it. But otherwise, she kind of still hoisting her foot around. We're wondering about, we're trying to encourage her to walk on it a little bit more now to strengthen it.
Mm-hmm.
She still has three pins in it that are going to be in for about another month.
Okay.
If they stay in, if they start to work out, they'll have to be taken out. But before then, what can we do to, should we be expecting her to be using it a little bit more all the time?
Anytime you've got a fracture like this and there's still hardware in place, I mean, that could be, the hardware itself could be causing some trouble depending on, how it's positioned. I'm not sure whether ends of the pin are out through the skin or whether they're embedded in, under the skin.
Yeah, they're still, the three that are there are still under the skin. But they've got to be a weird sensation.
Yeah, and so that may be part of it, that it's just bothering her a little bit that way. I wouldn't be too concerned, but what things that you could be looking at would be taking an x-ray to just see how healing's doing.
She's all healed up. She's had that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's healed good. The four are just in there, the three are still just in there for...
Yeah, and that might be something to consider, having them removed and maybe splinting the foot so that she can, after they're removed, you can still get a little support, but not as much as obviously having hardware in the joint. Dogs are pretty good. I mean, she's probably is painful, but they can sometimes forget about their pain when, they're chasing a cat, like you said. So I'd be more in tune to what she's doing when she's, not being asked to perform. And if she's favoring it, get it looked at again, and maybe those pins do need to come out.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I had a Facebook question, I believe, from Fountain City, from Sandy, who says, I have one cat who has herpes virus, hasn't had a vaccination since her days as a kitten at the shelter when she received everything she needed at that time. Periodically gets serious eye flare-ups, so I'm hesitant to give her any vaccinations. Also, I have another cat who gets very sick after rabies shots, and I don't want to give her any more. They're both indoor cats, both about four. Is this okay?
I would be, for me to say not to vaccinate your cat for rabies would be wrong. It is the law to have them vaccinated, even indoor cats, because if they were to bite somebody, you have to show proof that they're inoculated. One way we've been able to get around it for rabies is to do what's called rabies titers, and it's a blood sample that gets sent to a federal lab, the same place where my blood for my rabies titer gets sent, and they can check to see if the pet still has protective antibody levels, which would mean that your pet, does not require a booster vaccination. That way, hopefully, depending on the community that you're in, that would be accepted in lieu of actually having a piece of paper with, here's the date that the vaccination was given. When it comes to your cat that has chronic herpes, unfortunately, my guess is that your cat probably picked this up when it was a kitten in the shelter. Herpes is rhinotracheitis that cats get, and many cats carry it. It's kind of like us with our oral herpes or other herpes, that once you get herpes, it never goes away. And vaccinating is not going to prevent recurrences. It will maybe decrease the severity of the infections, but it's not going to stop it from coming back again. It's just whenever your cat's stressed, you're going to see some flare-ups that way too. So I would be recommending that you consider putting your cat on a lysine supplement. There's a number of different ways you can get it. You can get it at human health food stores. They do make it for cats in a palatable paste and powder. And this is an amino acid that is given, and you can use it daily, and it helps stop the viral replication. It doesn't stop it, but it inhibits it to some degree. It's safe. We use it all the time, and it's relatively inexpensive, and it may help prevent some of these flare-ups.
John and McFarland, your turn. Hi, John.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, doctor. I have a question about a new puppy we have, a Border Collie mix. He's about 6 weeks old. And do we, should we be looking to have his stool looked at for worms just as a matter of routine or?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, that's.
Or not, I guess.
Well, almost all puppies are born with parasites. And the probably the two big ones that we see that are transmitted from mom, either through the milk or across the placenta while the puppy's still in utero, are roundworms and hookworms. And the guidelines actually are that bitches should be dewormed and puppies should be dewormed. You know, for puppies starting at 2 weeks of age and doing it, giving them a dewormer for rounds and hooks every 2 weeks until they get to be about 10 or 12 weeks of age. So sometimes that will be in the form of their heartworm preventative. And so if, you know, your dog should be being a 6 week old dog on heartworm preventative right now. So it means a visit to your veterinarian to have that dispensed. They don't need to be blood tested right now. And that particular drug, all of the heartworm preventatives will help control roundworms and hookworms. But checking a stool sample will also look at other parasites that your puppy may have. We see Giardia in puppies, Coccidia in puppies, and they need different treatment. So when you go in for your first puppy appointment, bring a stool sample with you and your veterinarian can work their magic with it.
Do they all send them? And you were telling me, you were telling your audience about where you send certain things. That's where yours went. Is there a, I know not a national lab for this, but is there a respectable, I guess, where would I want to make sure my vet is sending these things to be looked at?
Well, usually stool samples are looked at in-house. It's a simple test called a zinc sulfate centrifuge test. But there are outside labs. I mean, we send a lot of our blood work for various tests that we don't run in-house at the vet school to Marshfield. They have a veterinary network, so that would maybe be the place that they might send their fecals as well.
All right, there you go. Thank you for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If animals are an important part of your family, I bet you want to keep them healthy and happy, but with new information coming out all the time and lots of different opinions, it's hard to know what to do if you're a responsible pet owner. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here for the next half hour to share new things and timely advice in the area of veterinary medicine. Whether you're a lifelong dog owner or maybe you can't imagine living without your cat or a cat or two around, Dr. Sandy is ready to answer your questions about your pet's health. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a photo, a pet photo, a question, or you can post a comment there as well. We'll be back with Dr. Sandy right after the news. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Sandy, great, as always, to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And lots of callers online and lots of emails and Facebook. We have an email from Kathy who says, I feel that many people are priced out of having pets because of the high costs of their health care, especially if they get sick. After spending many hundreds of dollars on my last two dogs and now my current dog, I have decided this will be my last pet. I feel that the vets really take advantage of the pet owners. And how do you respond to that?
You know, I think because so many humans have health care and they've got insurance, they don't see the true cost of what it means to run a practice. You know, most veterinarians are leaving vet school owing well over $100,000 in student loans. And it's, you know, so we've got education expenses. You have, you know, the dedicated nurses and so on, reception desks, your lighting, the equipment. And yes, veterinary medicine is now, you know, we've got the advances that have been made with everything from like having MRI units and chemotherapy and radiation therapy. There's all kinds of ways that you can go that are going to be expensive, because unless you've got health insurance for your pet, it's going to be all out of pocket for the owner. And that's something to consider when you get a dog. You know, be careful with what you get, you know, who you get. Do you want to get a dog that, I hate to say this about golden retrievers, but almost all of them die of cancer. I mean, it's very common for them to have that. So is that a breed that you want to take on, knowing that it may have those problems? But some simple things that owners can do to cut vet expenses. Number one, keep your pet slender. Okay. I know that they're like, well, why? I'm just going to be saving money on food. No, you're going to be saving money on skin infections, orthopedic disease, you know, all those things that go along with being overweight. Keep your dog on a good plane of nutrition, and using diets either that your veterinarian recommends, that are designed for your pet, for the age that your pet is at. And keep your pet up to date on parasite control, heartworm disease. Those, you know, all that preventative stuff really pays off, because all you need to do is have your dog get heartworm, and it's very expensive to treat it. It's much easier to prevent it. So, you know, I'm not going to apologize for what we charge, because, you know, I'm worth every penny that I charge.
Well, I saw starting salaries for veterinarians. The average veterinarian is not making a big pile of money.
Let's just say that a UPS driver makes about the same as a starting veterinarian. And yet they don't have the 100,000 plus or more education loans. So it's, it really takes someone who's dedicated. And, you know, I'm sorry if there's any MDs listening. There's a little, like, the vet students have these t-shirts that they wear that, say that MDs are veterinarians that are only smart enough to work on one species. I mean, the stuff that we have to learn is amazing. And it's harder to get into vet school than medical school. And, you know, and so.
And that's a true statement.
That is. It is. You can get into medical school much easier than you can vet school. And, you know, it amazes me how many years students will continue their education and reapply, or go down to the Caribbean to a vet school. And there's many good vet schools down there that take students that have not been able to get into U.S. vet schools, and they finish their education up here. And very expensive. And, yeah, so I'm not apologizing. I think we offer a service, and if pets are a luxury, and if you can't afford to have a pet, then obviously you shouldn't be getting it.
But you can do all those preventive things.
You can, and that's going to save, have the insurance, keep your pet lean, keep it healthy. And there are some, discount vaccination clinics and things that will help cut some costs. But, you know, in those cases, you're not getting the good physical exam and catching diseases and things early, so that you're not, all of a sudden stuck with, a horrible health problem for your pet.
Facebook question from Josh. My wife and I recently heard that tennis balls have been known to cause cancer in the mouths of dogs. Can't confirm it. Do you know?
Big thing with tennis balls, two things. One, they wear teeth down. I've mentioned that earlier. And they have never been linked to causing cancer, although there are some tennis balls that are out there that have higher contents of lead, which can result in problems if your dog is, chewing them. And so, and I'm drawing a blank on the website, but there is a website that's out there that you can put in the brand of tennis balls or toys, the things that your dog is chewing on, to be able to look at the safety factors, whether they, have high levels of lead or anything else that could be problematic for your dog. I think what, it's probably, people are seeing is the dog, the typical photo that you see of the dog is the golden retriever with three or four tennis balls in its mouth. And Goldens, I don't want to pick on them, but they are the breed that we see so much cancer in. And in fact, there is a new study that's coming out that is going to be a longevity study looking at golden retrievers, and it's going to go on for years. Dogs are being registered right now, and they every year they go through. It's almost like the same study that they're still doing with people out in, I'm not sure, it's out in the East Coast someplace, where they're looking at everything from pesticides that are used in the yard, what the dog is eating, preventive care, diets, exercise. genetics, all these things that are going to be looked at to try to see if we can get a better handle as to why these dogs are losing their life to these diseases.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Let's turn to Don in Antioch, Illinois. Hi,
Good
Don.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a two-year-old Morkie, cross between Maltese and a Yorkie.
Yep.
And he's dragging his butt on the ground, scratching his butt. And we notice that there is a, was it a hemorrhoid or... Is there something I need to take to...
Yeah, dogs typically don't get hemorrhoids. We don't see that in dogs, but we do see issues with their anal glands or anal sacs that sit on either side of the rectum. They can sometimes fill up with secretion and become infected, and maybe what you're seeing is actually a ruptured anal gland abscess. You'll see a, usually a draining tract just on either side of the rectum. Definitely something that requires a visit to your veterinarian. A groomer may express anal glands if you take your dog to a groomer. Usually they do this externally. And what your dog needs is a rectal exam to assess what those glands are like and what's in them and whether they need anything beyond just having them cleaned out or whether something they need to be on, puppy needs to be on medication to get rid of an infection, something like that. But also remember that dogs can scoot for other reasons. Tapeworms, they reproduce by producing little segments that leave through the anus and can make the dog itchy, and they'll suddenly put their bottom down in the ground and scoot if they've got something like that bothering them. So time to get into the veterinarian.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Pat in East Troy, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. Very timely for me. I had my golden retriever, into the vet yesterday to have her teeth cleaned, which, of course, required that she take gas for knocking her out for the process. Before we did that, the vet noticed that she had an inner eyelid that was extending over the eyeball more on one side than the other. And I saw what she meant, but it was minor. Today, that eye is almost covered with the same eyelid, and the other eye is starting.
Huh.
She has been on fluoxetine all her 4 years of life.
Prozac or fluoxetine would probably not result in changes in the third eyelid. What you're talking about is called the third eyelid, and it's that little flap of tissue in the corner of the eye that usually is out of, you can maybe just see the corner of it. Sometimes if you've got a gland problem of the third eyelid, it may, bulge out or make the lid look bigger. But what you're describing almost sounds like there's a nerve issue affecting the eye. There's a condition that affects dogs called and cats and humans called Horner's syndrome, which is a problem with the sympathetic nerve that runs to the eye. And when that nerve has been irritated, you can sometimes see the eye sinks back into the socket, and that third eyelid, because it's just passively moves as the eyeball moves back and forth, will come up in its place. So that I would maybe get your dog back in today if it's looking worse today, and have them looked at again to make sure that there isn't anything wrong with the eye itself. Or anything else that would point towards some type of nerve disorder that could be affecting your dog's eyes. Even though you were just in yesterday, get them back in today for a post-anesthetic recheck.
Thanks, Pat. Cal in Elkhorn, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sawchuk. I have a question about declawing cats. My friend said that he heard about a new procedure where the tendon behind the claw on a cat was snipped so that they couldn't extend their claws. Anytime you mention declawing a cat to me sounds bunk, but I was wondering if you knew anything about this and if this was any more humane than removing the claws altogether. And
yeah.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of ways of keeping cats from causing damage with their claws. One is, like, you know, standard declawing is actually removing, if you looked at the, you know, held your hand up and looked at the end of your fingers from the last joint, you know, on, removing that bone with all the nail producing tissue. Cats are different than us in that they don't weight bear on that or need, you know, that, well, I mean, obviously I'm not, you know, really pro or against declawing, but it's, you know, it is major surgical procedure that we have to be careful that it's done correctly. Back a few years ago, this method that you're describing called deep digital tendinectomy was, you know, people were batting that around whether this would be something that would be helpful so that the, you know, the cat just has to have some minor skin incisions to cut that tendon so that the claws remain up and sheathed by the tissue around the toes. And we tried that in a couple of cases at the vet school, and the big concern is that you have to trim the cat's nails almost on a weekly basis. I had a patient in that had this procedure done, and the owner failed to trim the nails, and the cat came in with every single one of those nails were like a big ram's horn. They had grown so long, they had come out and were piercing the pads, and the cat had a horrible foot infection and ended up having to be declawed the regular way afterwards. So if you have a cat that is easy to trim their nails, then this might be a procedure that you would do, and if you're dedicated to doing it all the time. If you can't, and this is one of the reasons why people will have their cat declawed because the cat resists having its nails trimmed, then do not do that surgery. It's going to be a nightmare for you and your cat down the road. So we've stopped doing it. We haven't done it for years at the vet school because of complications postoperatively with owner lack of management.
And you use, there are other ways to declaw that are.
You can do laser declaw. It's one of the other methods. It's still cutting the tissue, still doing the same thing, but they walk faster, they're up, there's less bleeding, they don't have to have a tourniquet on the leg during the surgery. It's obviously going to be a little more expensive because you're adding in the cost of that equipment and some training for the veterinarian to be able to use it. Back to the costs of veterinary medicine. You know, if you want this, you can do it the quick and dirty way, or we now can do with laser. So, you know, that's going to add to the cost. It's usually a little more expensive.
Let's go to Deb and Eau Claire next. Hi, Deb.
Oh, hi. Are you there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just retired from my career, and I bought a camper, and I'm going to go on a road trip with my dog.
Okay. Fun.
Yeah. Well, it's a golden retriever mix, and I asked my vet what I should do to make sure that my dog was fine on this trip. He's up on his shots. He just had a checkup in early August. He's perfectly healthy. The vet said just bring some Neosporin and some of those little splints you put on your finger if you split a nail. And I wondered if you had any more ideas that I should do to make sure that I'm prepared for any emergency that might occur on the road that I would need to.
What a good question. You know, I survived a tornado in January, and I, too, bought a small RV, and I've been taking my bulldogs on several trips, and it is definitely fun to be able to travel with your dogs. And, you know, obviously they need air conditioning, so we have to always find a place we can plug in and keep the thing cool for them. But I would be recommending that you get a pet first aid kit. You can make your own first aid kit as well. And you can, you know, going online, there's lots of information on things that you should put in a first aid kit. And, you know, having even a book on pet first aid, and I'm digging through my notes here because I was just looking up some stuff on pet first aid books, and the one that I would be recommending is the first aid companion for dogs and cats by Amy Shoe, Shojai. That was when I was looking at all the books, probably the one that's the most comprehensive. So having that available, knowing where you're going to be traveling to, like I just had somebody come in this morning that is going to be moving to Florida, and I'm like, well, year-round heartworm control, year-round flea control, because they have issues with parasites down there that are up in this area not as critical in the winter. So, you know, that would be something, depending on the area that you're going to, know the diseases that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Making sure that you travel with your dog's, you know, all your dog's medical records, so that any veterinarian, if you have to go in on emergency, knows what your dog has been treated for. And vaccination records, obviously, because you need to, you know, travel with those as well. And, you know, a good supply of food so that you're not in the middle of nowhere and having to make a sudden diet change. Other things that I would be having probably on hand, and this would be something your veterinarian would have to talk, you'd have to talk to them as to whether they'd feel comfortable giving it to you, would be maybe some medication for diarrhea, like some metronidazole, similar to what people would take when they go to Mexico. You know, you have it on hand in case you get Montezuma's revenge. So having some extra medications on hand wouldn't be a bad idea. And I've even given some owners, or actually sold them, not given, a little staple gun. They use them and for surgery and then re-sterilize them, and they have a few staples in there if you get like a minor skin wound. Obviously, this wouldn't be something that you would, you know, just leave. You would still seek out veterinary care, but at least you could potentially close a gaping wound if you needed to. So there's lots of things like that available, but I think a first aid kit is the best thing you can have.
And that will fill up the rest of my camper.
There you go. Yeah.
There you go. Hey, it sounds like a lot of fun, Dad. What's your dog's name?
Homer.
So it travels with Homer.
Homer, yes. You'll have to write into the Facebook page and fill us in on your travels.
Okay, thank you so much for your help.
Yeah, thanks, Deb. Thanks a lot for calling. That sounds like fun. Good, quite an adventure. Joel and Madison, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I've got a couple of things. I know there's been a lot of questions with people with pets with skin itchy issues.
Mm-hmm.
My parents found a product through their veterinarian, and haven't found it up here except for online, but I wanted to share the product. It's called Microtech, T-E-K, by a company called Equis, E-Q-Y-S-S. It's great for any skin itches that might be related to summer allergies, hot spots,
what is it?
Worms.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, hang on just a second. I mean, it works great. We've had it on some Bichons that had hot spots, and just made the insane itch stop immediately.
But the
active ingredient is triclocarbon.
Triclocarbon. Yeah, no idea what that is.
Centrum chloride and a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm sorry, I can't.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do, I've written this down. I'll do a little looking into it and check with our dermatology folks as to whether, you know, this would be something that would be worthwhile recommending. Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of pet products out there where everything is just kind of testimonials that it worked for my dog, and so, you know, use it. But I have no idea about safety, and especially if you're dealing with a dog that's licking the product off, is this going to be something that could be a problem? So before I recommend it, I'm going to do a little work myself, and I'll let people know on the next show as to whether this would be something that they should be looking into.
Check out their website. They do have a website.
Okay.
All right.
But at any rate, the other thing, I know we're running short on time, but I was hoping you could discuss pros and cons of pet insurance. What types of things might it cover? Is it really worth the investment?
Mm-hmm.
Do all veterinarians accept it?
Yeah, it is. Pet insurance for pets is very different than human insurance. You go in, you pay for the vet service, and then you turn the bills in to the company. And it really, you have to do your homework to find out if that particular company is one that is going to meet the needs of your pet. You know, I carry pet insurance on both my dogs. And the reason I do is because I don't do surgery. And all I need is one major surgical problem and I'm in trouble. And it has paid off, at least for one of my dogs, to have it. Yes, it costs me about $400 a year because they're elderly bulldogs, but I think it's worth it. You have to get it early because pre-existing conditions often aren't handled. Some problems we have are with, you know, certain breeds of dogs. They may not cover any congenital problems that they may have. So do your homework ahead of time. And the American Animal Hospital Association, I believe on their website has some information on pet insurance. And don't hold me to that, but that would be probably one of the places I would look. Or the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association site, they may have some information on there on the different companies.
Mm-hmm. And you're happy with your company? And
oh, we've had our ups and downs, and I've had to scream at them a few times. But they basically, you know, I know how to kind of play the game with them. Would I recommend the company that I have right now to my clients? No, because they are difficult to work with. You have to be a medical professional to be able to know how to submit the right things. But there are many companies out there that work really well.
That do a good job.
Yep. But I can't get my dogs, you know, with them because they already have pre-existing conditions. So I'm stuck. I can't change. Yeah.
Oh. Is one quickie here from Jackie in Brookfield. If we don't board our dogs in a public kennel, is it necessary to get Bordetella vaccine every year?
Well, Bordetella is like whooping cough in people, and it depends on your dog's lifestyle. If they're going to dog parks, doggy daycare, the groomer even is the spot where dogs can pick this up. So it really depends on the lifestyle. And if they're around other dogs, get it done every year.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. I think I'm back on the 11th or 12th or something.
Somewhere here I've got it. Yep. Let's see. October 9th.
October 9th. There you go.
So Tuesday, the next Tuesday in October is that you're going to be on is the 9th. Thanks, Sandy.
Hey, you're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm sorry, it's lots of Facebook and email questions as well, and I'm sorry we just didn't get to everybody, but sometimes, or frankly, every day that happens. We never get to everybody, unfortunately. But look, let's look ahead and see who's going to be on the docket tomorrow and who you may or may not get to. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, actually. I hope you'll join in. I hope you'll send in your questions and comments or call. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.